I lost the image for a while, and after Mother leaving the body, I had the vision one more time, and this time that the tree had grown larger, who was myself, and the great oak tree was no longer there. But what had happened was that the substance of the great oak tree had gone back down into the soil, and that's what I was drawing up for my own nurturance, for my own strength, for my own development. So I think that I told that story at one point, and Earl said that he had a song about a tree. It reminded him. He came and played that for me one time, and I just loved it. I still do. I would like to read from something that I wrote the other day, entitled Moods. Moods destroy peace. When we are controlled by our moods, we become subject to the whim of our internal world. Moods will lash us about, destroying our peace and inhibiting our vision of God. Moods have no other purpose than to fulfill themselves. From a spiritual standpoint, they are soul-killing. To gain mastery over moods, we must first acknowledge their essential baseless nature. Moods are instigated by some attachment to how we think things should be. If things are going along about how we think they should be, then we are in a good mood. If life does not match some internal picture of how it's supposed to be, then we feel let down, out of sorts, resentful, bitter, angry, etc. These basic assumptions lie deeply hidden in the subconscious mind. If we are single and we think we should be married, we are unhappy. If we are married and wish we were single, we are unhappy. Whatever template or filter we see the world through determines our mood. If going to the gym produces sweat, strain, and requires great energy, we say that is a good workout. If we do physical hard labor, but all the while thinking, I should be an executive sitting in an easy chair, bitterness seeps into each day and slowly kills the spirit. The act of physical strain may be the same, but our view of it is completely different, thereby creating different moods. Creating positive moods by making our world match our ideas of how it should be is a good thing to practice in the development of the ego, but ultimately it is futile in achieving ultimate peace. If we are successful in our business, have a lovely home, spouse, and children, whatever dream we may have for ourselves, even if this picture and our world were perfect, it would be insufficient. The shadow side is always present. We could lose any one of those things through misfortune or ultimately at the time of death. This fear is ever present, at least on a subconscious level. Therefore, our peace cannot be complete. If we are able to come to terms with this prospect, we must transcend duality and our attachment to it. For every good, bright thing in this world, there is its polar opposite. This is duality. Therefore, it is literally impossible to have light without its accompanying darkness in this worldly realm. To resolve this thrown with roses problem, we come to accept that this duality is the case of this world. This may be done by one of two basic approaches, by acceptance or renunciation. Acceptance requires that we see all that happens to us and to the world at large as being for the higher good. We either see or accept by faith that no matter what happens, there is some elevating purpose in it. Now this flies in the face of how most individuals view the world. If we see some senseless act of cruelty or fatal accident, our descriptive words reveal our view that these incidents are not connected with any edifying purpose. A spiritual view of the world reveals that consciousness is ever-evolving. Through painful circumstances, we can bravely meet our past that occurs through the law of cause and effect, and learn to be in the world in a new way due to those experiences, and thereby learn and love more completely than ever before. We either take it on faith or come to a realized vision that every circumstance is for our individual and collective higher good. Sometimes the lesson may be sterling examples of what not to do, and through those lessons, we more clearly approximate what does work. Other times, it is seeing how a hero in action. By noticing this, we find new ways to be in this world. Renunciation is the other view. To renounce this world is to affirm our essential nature as spirit, being beyond all this confounding duality. We declare this world can only give pain with its pleasure, and we seek that self that is beyond the pairs of opposites. In order to do this, we withdraw the attention of our mind, seek out realization of the self who is above duality. In this way, we rise aloof to the competing poles of the world and recognize preeminent soul shining above creation. Thus discovering our eternal self, we gain peace, leaving the world far behind. Two approaches, one goal. Mountain climbers may approach a peak from different directions, yet the view is the same once the goal is reached. We may even choose to combine these two paths, seeking out the self in deep meditation, then entering the world and seeing it as God's play, the evolution of creation to divine consciousness. In either case, our attachment to our ideas of how life should be keeps us from having this universal vision. The mind must be purified of these attachments in order to experience real peace. Single-pointed attention through acceptance or renunciation is the path. In acceptance, we single-pointedly see the hand of God in every person, place, and situation, ignoring our attachments. Renunciation requires the attention be withdrawn from the world and placed on the eternal self. Thus, we have started it all by identifying the issue, diagnosing its cause, and creating a goal for resolving the issue. For either path, chanting God's name is a wonderful way to purify the mind. Putting our attachment on this single source, God, we let go of our old attachments and seek new freedoms. And from the autobiography of a yogi. One afternoon, during my early months at the ashram, I found Sri Yukteswar's eyes fixed on me piercingly. "You are too thin, Mukunda." His remark struck a sensitive point. That my sunken eyes and emaciated appearance were far from my liking was testified to the rows of tonics in my room at Calcutta. Nothing availed. Chronic dyspepsia had pursued me since childhood. My despair reached an occasional zenith when I asked myself if it were worthwhile to carry on this life with a body so unsound. "Medicines have limitations. The creative life force has none. Believe that you shall be well and strong." Sri Yukteswar's words aroused a conviction of personally applicable truth which no other healer, and I had tried many, had been able to summon within me. Day by day, behold, I waxed. 2 weeks after Master's hidden blessings, I had accumulated the invigorating weight which eluded me in the past. My persistent stomach ailments vanished with lifelong permanency. On later occasions, I witnessed my guru's instantaneous divine healings of persons suffering from ominous disease, tuberculosis, diabetes, epilepsy, or paralysis. Not one of them have been more grateful for his cure than I was at sudden freedom from my cadaverous aspect. Years ago, I too was anxious to put on weight, Sri Yukteswar told me. During convalescence, after a severe illness, I visited Lahari Mahasaya in Benares. Sir, I have been very sick and lost many pounds. I see, Yukteswar, you made yourself unwell, and now you think yourself thin. This reply was far from the one I had expected. My guru, however, added encouragement, let me see. I am sure you ought to feel better tomorrow. Taking his words as a gesture of secret healing toward my receptive mind, I was not surprised the next morning at a welcome ascension of strength. I sought out my master and exclaimed exultingly, Sir, I feel much better today. Indeed, today you invigorate yourself. No, master, I protested. It was you who helped me. This is the first time in weeks I have had any energy. Oh, yes, your malady has been quite serious. Your body is frail yet. Who can say how it will be tomorrow? The thought of possible return of my weakness brought about a shudder of cold fear. The next morning I could hardly drag myself to Lahari Mahasaya's home. Sir, I am ailing again. My guru's glance was quizzical. So? Once more you indispose yourself. Gurudev, I realize now that day by day you have been ridiculing me. My patience was exhausted. I don't understand. Why do you disbelieve my truthful reports? Really, it has been your thoughts that have made you feel alternately weak and strong. My master looked at me affectionately. You have seen how your health has exactly followed your expectations. Thought is a force, even as electricity or gravitation. The human mind is a spark of the almighty consciousness of God. I could show you that whatever your powerful mind believes very intensely would instantly come to pass. Knowing that Lahari Mahasaya never spoke idly, I addressed him with great awe and gratitude. Master, if I think I am well and have regained my former weight, shall that happen? It is so, even at this moment. My guru spoke gravely, his gaze concentrated on my eyes. Lo, I felt an increase not alone of strength, but of weight. Lahari Mahasaya retreated into silence. After a few hours at his feet, I returned to my mother's home, where I stayed during my visits to Benares. My son, what is the matter? Are you swelling with dropsy? Mother could barely believe her eyes. My body, now of the same robust dimensions that I possessed before my illness. I weighed myself and found that in one day I gained 50 pounds. They remained with me permanently. Friends and acquaintances who had seen my thin figure were aghast with wonderment. A number of them changed their mode of life and became disciples of Lahari Mahasaya as a result of this miracle. My guru, awakened God, knew this world to be nothing but an objectified dream of the Creator. Because he was completely aware of his unity with the divine dreamer, Lahari Mahasaya could materialize or dematerialize or make any change he wished in the cosmic vision. All creation is governed by law, Sri Yukteswar concluded. The ones which manifest in the outer universe, discoverable by scientists, are called natural laws. But there are subtler laws ruling the realms of consciousness which can be known only through the inner science of yoga. The hidden spiritual planes also have their natural and lawful principles of operation. It is not the physical sciences, but the fully self-realized master who comprehends the true nature of matter. Thus Christ was able to restore a servant's ear after it had been severed by one of his disciples. would like to speak this evening of the world of illusion. We have here an example of a great master who was able to, with the power of their thought, change the very physical cosmos about which they live. This is the truth for all of us, but for most of us it is unrealized potential. What is required in order to realize this is to attune this consciousness with the higher consciousness of divine mind. The divine mind resides within us, and yet for most people, it is latent. It has not yet been fully manifest. We are told that this is the ultimate evolutionary course for every human being who walks the earth, indeed, every sentient life. And sentient life can even be traced to pre-animal life, to the vegetable kingdom, and even the mineral kingdom. Because ultimately, all of this creation is an extension and a manifestation of God consciousness. Now, God is the original creative consciousness that has brought everything into creation. And so, by realizing this, we unite this conscious mind with the infinite mind. The infinite mind is vast. When we say infinite, the human mind cannot comprehend what that means. It is only through inner realization that infinity can be at once perceived. There are many wonderful experiences that come to us as we enter upon this path. I talked about the path of the tree earlier in terms of the vision that I had of myself. And in truth, we all start out as that seedling, a seedling that holds great promise and great potential. Now, in the beginning, that seedling needs protection. It is the seedling of Christ consciousness. Now, Christ is not used here in a sectarian kind of a way, but rather it describes a universal principle. The principle is this. In the beginning is spirit unmanifest, and that is referred to as God the Father in a Christian or Western sense. And then God breathed out, or through thought, manifested all of physical creation. Now, all of thought has a vibrational rate that goes with it. From this highest spiritual rate, it might be said that that is the highest vibration of which we can attain to. Now, we know this through the sound that travels through the air here. If we hear music, we hear perhaps deep vibrational tones of a bass, or we have the high-pitched tones of the human voice or different instruments, and all the ranges in between. And we can feel, if we are sensitive to it, the different effects that occurs in our body based on these different sounds. From this highest thought, or the causal realm, comes the astral projection, or that this vibration is slowed down and put into a new realm. And through this, light bodies are created, and they are essentially energy. And they have this vibrancy of light about them that the causal realm does not have, because it has not yet come down into that realm of being. Now, from that comes this physical realm, and this is vibration taken even to a lower rate. And it comes and it forms itself as rocks, as trees, as water, as the vegetable kingdom, the animal kingdom, and ultimately human beings. Now, human beings are said to be the pinnacle of creation. Why is this? It is not because they have come from any different source than any of the rest of creation. But when vibration comes into the mineral kingdom, it is essentially inert. It has a vibrancy to it It has a consciousness and intelligence to it, but it is of a very limited sort. When it comes into the vegetable kingdom and all of creation that happens around that, it quickens itself a bit, and it has the ability to grow and to become something. It starts off in seed form, generally, and evolves into a full-grown example of itself and reproduces itself. When vibrancy comes into the animal kingdom, it again refines itself and quickens itself to a greater degree. It is able to perceive the world through different avenues. It is able to have a reflex to the world and to have that state of movement that is unique to itself. When it comes into humankind, it has the uniqueness of the 7 cerebral spinal centers that make it capable of realizing its conscious union with that infinite consciousness. And so it is the unique creation, and that is what is referred to as the Son of Man. Now, this does not mean men and versus women, but more as mankind, all of humankind. And so this creation is unique from that standpoint, that it has these 7 centers. Now, when the original creative force, or God, the Father, breathed out or manifested itself through these different vibrational capacities and realms, it became God the Mother, or Mother Nature. It is the expression of spirit in all of its multifacetedness. Now, this is the beginning of duality between Father God and Mother God, or God as pure spirit and Mother as expression of that spirit through all of creation. Now, this is God itself who has become manifest. To say that God created the world isn't quite accurate, because in our minds, when we think of creating something, we think of taking some materials that's separate from ourselves, and we make something out of it. In this case, it is the manifestation of the very essence, the basic stuff, of which that original creative force was, that has become all of this material creation. Now, it is given this ability to have flux. It is, in the Adam and Eve story, entering into the world of knowledge of good and evil, because it has the ability to separate itself consciously from God. Now, mankind has that unique and sometimes lamentable ability to do this. And so we are given free will, and we can consciously create that disunion between spirit and our own individualized consciousness. It's quite a thing when you think about it, and it's unique to mankind. All else operates through automatic principle. Although animals can gain affection and have loyalty and all the rest of it, their ability to make choices for themselves is extremely limited, whereas mankind can create a great multifaceted way of all the ways to create separation between ourselves and the Creator. Now, this is inviolable, this free will. This is something that has been given to us, and unless we pervert ourselves to the point of becoming so completely evil that we are dissolved back into the universal consciousness, then we are on this progression towards this universal vision, this highest form of consciousness of which we are all made. Now, creation seeks to find itself. It seeks to create union with itself. From a human standpoint, we seek to do this primarily through sexuality, but we also do it through many other forms. but both by polarity and in a psycho-emotional sense, sexuality is the greatest source of this. By polarity, it is at the opposite extreme of the Sahasrara, or the crown chakra. And because the sexual chakra lies at the base of the spine and is the furthest away, it is the greatest extension. Psychologically and emotionally it is, because we seek out our divine partnership in another human being. Now, in a human sense, there is nothing wrong with this. This is the way of procreation. This is the way that the human race continues its own evolution. But from a spiritual standpoint, when we turn ourselves towards creating union with the infinite, we have to turn away, so to speak, from that mode of expression through sexuality. Now, in our sadhana, in our path toward God, we can continue to have a sexual life if we are married, because by that means we can discover a greater sense of union with our partner, and through that way, we feel uplifted and transformed. Now, from a spiritual standpoint, we should be married. Now, sometimes you hear the saying that, well, that's just a piece of paper, because it's been turned into a legal document. But originally, there is no such thing as the government being involved in this kind of thing, and so it wasn't intended to be a legal document. That has to do with the exchange of material and land and on down through the generations. And it has nothing to do with the spiritual sense of it. The spiritual sense is that when two souls come together, they are united in front of God, or the universal vision. They bring themselves before that altar, and before their friends, and before a priest or a minister, someone who can spiritually join them together. Because this helps to stabilize the union for many reasons. One is for children. But the spiritual sense of it is so that those two come together very intentionally. They create and hold a union whereby their souls are joined together in a commitment to not only to honor each other, but to honor God within each other and the spiritual path that each has to follow. Now, in order for a spiritual union of this sort to be successful, each individual must honor the path of God in the other and support it. Now, they cannot live it for the other person, nor can they be responsible for it. But they need to do everything in their power to bring about the conditions of a peaceful, harmonious life where both souls can create a union, not only with each other, but the infinite spirit. You know, being a counselor, I've worked with many couples who come in for couples counseling. And there is so much in the way of resentment. There is so much in the way of bitterness, of anger, that resides within the soul. And they see the other individual as responsible because they are angry. And they want the other individual to change or to do something different in order to resolve the relationship. Now, when you have both individuals coming in with the same mind, the other person needs to change. You've got an intractable situation. And because of that, many marriages stay intractable. Hearts become hardened. Harsh words are said that sometimes are difficult to forget. Sometimes there is deliberate acts of cruelty. There is a therapist that calls it normal marriage sadism, and that is the withholding of one for the other. You know what the other person wants, and it'll be the last thing in the world that you'll be likely to do, because you're angry with that one, You're disappointed in that one, and so you withhold yourself. Now, this is a very easy thing to get into from a human standpoint. But from a spiritual standpoint, it definitely retards your progress. It does not make for a peaceful union between two individuals. What needs to happen in order to resolve this is that two people both need to take responsibility for their own projections of how they hoped the union would be, how they hoped the situation may be. Now, there may be some cases where there is deliberate cruelty going on by one to another, and this is not good, and somebody shouldn't stay in that union when that's the case, because that will be to the detriment of both. But that's rare, really. Usually people have some mind to want to change. They have some mind to want to make things different. And as long as there is a willingness, as long as there is a desire to make that change occur, then every effort should be made in order to realize that. Now, someone may say, well, I'm no longer in love with my spouse. What do I do about that? Well, love is a feeling, and feelings come and they go. Sometimes they're there and sometimes they're not. And then even in unions where people love each other very deeply, there can be times when you don't actively have that feeling in your heart. This is normal. So we can't always measure things by what we're feeling in a particular moment. We may say, well, we're not being fulfilled in this relationship. The person who's responsible for that fulfillment is you, is the individual. And they are the ones that are responsible to finding happiness in which way they can. Because the greatest and the ultimate happiness comes from spiritual union. All human endeavors, all relationships will sometime fade, will sometimes go through difficulty. And so there again, we cannot always measure a relationship based on what we're feeling in the moment. But rather, we need to go deeper inside of our souls, deeper inside of ourselves. And oftentimes, what we will find is that the anger and the resentment and the hard-heartedness that we are harboring for the other is something that lies deep within ourselves. And because of this, there is only one place that can change. So oftentimes people will leave one partner and go out and seek another. And either they find someone who is just like the old partner, or they'll find their polar opposite. And in either case, they are not making decisions out of wisdom. They are living in a state of reactivity. Now, there are two ways to live this life. One is from our soul inspiration, from deep inside of who we know ourselves to be. And we don't live out of reaction. In other words, if somebody else is angry, we get angry just because. That's reactivity. But rather, we stay calm in ourselves. Now, if we have feelings of anger that flow through us, it is because of something that is initiated inside of us, not living in reaction. Now, this is a great discipline to enter into, is to begin to live your life more from your own wisdom mind, your more soul direction inside of you, and not so much living in reaction to the world. How is it that we know we're living in reaction? Sometimes we're in a situation and somebody says something that perhaps offends us or makes us feel bad about ourselves or somebody else. And we reason inside of ourselves, usually after the fact, well, if it were just a normal situation, I'd probably have a reaction level of a 2 or a 3 on an intensity level of a 10. But my reaction intensity was a 9 or a 10. The difference between that 2 or 3 and that 9 or 10 is your level of reactivity. And those issues are about you, not about the other person. And so that's a good indication that there's some work for you to do. One is to begin to examine yourself. Why is it that I felt so reactive in this situation? One, for myself, one of the things, I grew up with a father who was extremely exacting. You would ask him some simple question, and the next thing you knew, you were getting a monologue about something that went into great depth and detail about something I cared for not so ever. And, so I have some buttons around that in the past. And so whenever I got somebody who went into too much detail about something, I would feel myself growing angry or restless or wanting to get out of there or somehow close the situation down. Now, since that time, I've created a little more tolerance for that. I can still find its residue in me at different times when I find somebody who's a little monotonous or boring or too detailed about something. So then it's a good time to chant Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram and put my mind on something that's a little more satisfying. But this is the way that we can train ourselves. And we begin to see where it is that we have that level of reactivity. Because when we're there, we are no longer master of ourselves. Rather, we are allowing the world to master us. We are not living out of our soul, but we are rather living in reaction to what the world is telling us or how it is treating us. Now, Jesus said this in the way of loving your neighbor. He said, do not just love the people who love you. Even the publicans, even the Pharisees, even the Sadducees do this much. It is easy to love people who love you. It is easy to have positive feelings about people who make you feel good. But he said, love your enemy. Now, at the time, in that culture, this was a brand new and quite startling teaching. Love your enemy. It had been seen as justifiable to hate your enemy, to revile your enemy, to kill your enemy if that's what was required. But to love your enemy? And we might well ask, how could we love our enemy? How could we love somebody who dislikes us, who calls us up short on ourselves, who perhaps performs evil in the world? How can that be? And so it takes quite a test in order to love all, even as you love yourself. But here is a great key. In loving ourselves, we have loved all that we have ever been or that we are ever likely to be. Now, having lived so many lifetimes, not even to speak of all the variety of roles we played in this lifetime, that's quite a task. It's quite a task. How do you love yourself? Can you love yourself? From a human standpoint, this is a very difficult, if not impossible, thing. Because we have reactions to people in this world. If we were to meet an Adolf Hitler or a Stalin or a Mao who are responsible for millions, the slaughter of millions upon millions, could we love them? Could we find compassion in our heart for them? Would we not think an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth? And would we not want to seek vengeance on them? So how is it that we can muster the courage to love such ones? The third aspect of creation is the Christ. In India, this is Krishna. In Taoism, this is the way. In Buddhism, this is Nirvana. Many different religions, many different philosophies, but all describing the same quality of spirit, the same consciousness. Now, this is the purity of that highest vibration of God the Father consciousness that has been projected out and all to the multifaceted vibrations of God the Mother, material creation. Now we have every level of vibration within material consciousness except for that highest spiritual consciousness, because remember, that's where duality was created in the beginning. There was a separation between materiality and spirit. But sown in the seeds, in the cells, in the atoms of all of material creation is this highest vibration of Christ consciousness. And because of that, it can be rightly said to be the Savior. It is that that can lift us out of all the different levels of vibrations of material creation and take us to the highest level of spiritual creation. Isn't that marvelous? Without it, we would be doomed to just sweeping the dust around, but never getting in the waste pan and taking it outdoors. It would just be an endless task. We could try to refine this ego to some extent, but we would be left with the same conclusion that Freud was, which was, the best we can do is become the minimum amount of neurosis. Not a very pleasing prospect. Not a very pleasing one. So from a human standpoint, this is completely understandable conclusion to come to, that all we can become is the minimum amount of neurosis. Fortunately, this is not our design, and this is not the case. What is the case is that deeply sown within us, in the reservoirs of our unconscious mind, is this seed of Christ or Krishna or Nirvana consciousness. It is the Buddha. The Buddha is the awakened one. Now, for most mankind, this resides dormant. But all the teachings, all the prophecies, all the religions are here but for one purpose, and that is to awaken us to this divine possibility. Now, the fact that most religions, most teachings do not do this, they do not go directly to this, is not the fault of the original teachings. It is the ones who have followed, who have come behind, who have interpreted it through their own mental apparatus. And since we have just recently come through the Kali Yuga, or an age of darkness, the Dark Ages, much of what was given in the past was seen through those filters of those minds during the Dark Ages. And so they saw everything from a very material standpoint, so that Christ became a human being. As early as 200 AD, after the death of Christ, there was arguments going on within the church as to whether Jesus ever existed as a human being or whether he was purely a spiritual emanation and that it was all allegory. So this discussion had been going on the whole time. Now, St. Anthony came out of the desert and, having had a great vision of his own inner Christ, stood up during this debate and said, I have seen him. And he was a 90-year-old renunciant who had tremendous respect from everybody and stopped the discussion now. Now, what he saw was the Christ of his own self. And yet it was taken as being a human being that had lived 200 years before. And so the mythology began to take on greater and greater credence. And as it moved through the material dark ages, it became solidified into a human being who lived now, at this point, 2,000 years ago, who was the Savior. You see, this was not the original teachings. This was not the original intent. The original teachings were, it was this Christ spirit. that came in human form, became flesh, not the flesh of just one individual, but the flesh of all humankind, and was the saving grace of all humankind. And this is the truth, but it's universal, you see. It's universal. It doesn't just regard one religion, and everybody else is left out. You see, this would not be a good plan. Not a good plan at all. So it's not even worthy of a creative consciousness that has brought all this beauty, all this loveliness, all of this that we see as creation into being. Every human being has that saving grace, regardless of their race, regardless of their religion, regardless of their thought process. God, fortunately, does not need us for affirmation of his own existence. We, fortunately or unfortunately, need his assent. We need his conscious projection into human form. And we have it. And we have that free will. Now, all humankind is on a march towards that divine quest. Some are actively marching away from divine consciousness. Papa Ram Dass used to say there are three types of individuals, three types of souls. One is like the mudworm. You take the mudworm out of the mud and you wash him off, and he's thoroughly uncomfortable. And all he dreams about and thinks about is getting back into the mud again. He says, then there's the soul that's like the fly. The fly will land on a flower, but then it'll land on a manure pile. And it makes no discrimination between the two whatsoever. And then there is the soul that's like the honeybee. And it only lands on the flower and gets the nectar from there. Likewise, the mudworms of souls are in this world, and they don't want anything of spirituality. In fact, it makes them uncomfortable and is painful for them. So all they want is to live in the mud. So let them. Because to do anything else would be to disturb their comfort. And then there are those that love. And then there are others who have just a very limited tolerance for it. My parents, which I call C&E people, they're Christmas and Easter. That's when they go to church usually. Although that's changed in their later years. You know, it's amazing how you get closer to death. You know, the issue becomes a little more important. It seems a little larger in your life. Anyhow, so these are the varying stages. So it's very humorous that, as Papa told about these three states, that there's a woman there who is listening to Papa, and she says, well, Papa, she says, I must be like the fly. She says, I've enjoyed very much all of that you've had to say here, but now I want to go see a movie. So he was wanting to go out and experience some of the material aspects of life. And everybody had a good laugh. You see, you don't want to disturb somebody unduly from the place where they're at in their life. If they are attuned to a very worldly, material consciousness, then there is enough in the scriptures in terms of living a good life, in terms of doing right unto others. And if they live by these laws, then they advance spiritually to the degree that they can in that lifetime. But for another soul, they are on the cusp. They are on the edge, and perhaps they see your life. Perhaps they see something in you. They experience something when you're in their presence. They feel a little more calm. They feel some peace, maybe an upliftment. Maybe they see the light in your eyes or in your face, and they're attracted to that. They want something of it. And so they ask you about your life. And it's at that time that you can tell them about the spiritual consciousness and about how you're seeking it out and trying to experience it, and trying to become more united with it. and you can give them everything as God within you directs you to. But other than that, we shouldn't necessarily go out advertising the fact, because it is when the soul is ready that they are attracted to the teacher and the teachings and the path. And until they are ready for that, they should be left exactly where they are. And hopefully they take to heart the teachings of good morality, that they're honest in their business, that they're truthful with their friends, that they live a life of integrity. And if they are of that mode, then they are advancing. And sometimes you find people who speak much of the spiritual path, but they don't live it. They don't even live the basic lives of being in tune with even the basic laws. And so they don't do themselves any good, nor do their teachings, because they are not carrying that vibration with them. So when you attune yourself to this highest vibration, it takes some time usually. Usually you go into it and then you come back out of it. And then you go back into it again. And then you come back out of it. And in and out you go. And if you're sincere, and if the desire nature in you is great, then you make steady progress on the unfoldment of that consciousness that's within you. And you begin to attract to yourself those situations, those people, those things that will help you in your evolution from the human to the divine. And when you accept every notion, every situation, every person as coming to you for your own highest good, for your own teaching, then you accept them in the highest light. When you think of God always, you attract a thrice blessing. The first blessing is on yourself, because you're attuning your consciousness to the highest consciousness. Secondly, you, whoever you're focusing upon, whoever you're around, you bless them, because you send out from yourself that vibration of consciousness, and it affects them. And it is a thrice blessing, because it goes out all over this world and it affects this world. You can't know of the effects that you have on the world. One time, a cute idea came to me about a yawn. And there's a person walking down the street and they yawned. Well, you know how yawns can be contagious. So the person who was looking at them, walking the other direction, yawned. Well, the person walking past them picked up the yawn as well, and so it came into a building, and it passed itself on as one person after another picked up the yawn. Well, suddenly it made its way all the way into a TV studio, and the cameraman behind the camera yawned, and which made the person in front of the camera yawn, which then went out all over the airwaves everywhere and made the whole country yawn. So you never know what's going to happen when you put out an action, who that's going to affect, and how far that effect is going to spread out over this vast world. You never know how many people have been in your life, and just a word, just their presence, something that they have done has made a change in your life, made life a little better for you. And you've gone out and perhaps made somebody else's life a little better because you are in a better mood. You see, you don't know the full implication. And so you take every situation as sacred, every individual as divine. And you don't separate out into your world this way or that, that this is of God and this other is not. You see, because that's a false distinction. So this Christ consciousness, this Krishna consciousness, the way, the Buddha, all of it is describing this highest consciousness of which we are all part and parcel. And if we would be spiritually courageous, spiritually adventurous enough, then we too could begin to awaken those latent energies within us. The most basic and the most fundamental concepts around this is to keep your mind on God always. Now, this is no easy thing to do. We perhaps sit in meditation for a while and we feel peaceful inside. We feel in communion with that higher spiritual vibration. And then we go out and we start mixing in the world. And suddenly we find that our vibration level has been brought down to the person that we're mixing with or the people that we're mixing with. And so it takes constant attention. It takes that commitment. It takes that ability to really focus your mind on no matter what is happening, unheard by any, deeply resounding in your soul is that God, God, God. And when you attune yourself to that vibration, to that level, then that healing vibration goes out. And all this material cosmos becomes subject to the divine will inside of you. Because no longer are you a human being in the normal sense of the word. You're not run by human desires, by all the little ego running after this and that and the other thing. But you live your life inspired by the divine. And you are no longer living in reactivity to this world. But you are an actor on it. And you put yourself forward. And that vibration goes out from you and affects all this vast world. Try it sometime. Just be in that fullness of consciousness. And just extend it out. If you're riding a bus, or if you're in a car and you see other people, if you're in a crowd, just in your own mind's eye, imagine that divine force going out from you and permeating everyone. Even as a rose wafts out its scent, it doesn't ask for anything in return. It is just being exactly what it's being. And so as a spiritual soul, you are the same. You are just being yourself. But allow that sweetness of spirit to emanate out from you. Let it manifest in all the relationships in your life. And you will see a change in yourself and in those around you. But you don't live in anticipation of that change because you accept whatever is given to you is coming from the Almighty. And in this way, bit by bit, your consciousness is transformed. And you come into the healing vibrations of that spiritual consciousness of which you are part and parcel. And you realize, not just through an idea or a philosophy, or because I said so or somebody else said so, or because it is written someplace. But you realize it because every cell in your body, in your being, resonates to that truth. And you realize that you are, that you always have been, and you always will be, one with that eternal vibration of God. And then you see God the Mother, God the Father, God the Son all come into one radiant expression. And then you know yourself to be truly one with that. And this is the most wonderful thing that we can experience. And it is the fulfillment of the promise of all the prophets and of all the scriptures. And it resides right within you. Right within you. You don't need to wait until you die. some other time, some other place, some other lifetime. None of it. It's right here. As potent and vibrant as it ever has been. And if you open your heart to it, and open your mind and your consciousness to it, you can experience it and know it. I think many of you know that I recently left the place where I've been working for the last 12 years, and I'm spending this month up on Hornby Island, and so far most of it's been in a time of seclusion. But the wonderful experiences, you know, it's been, I was thinking about it earlier today, it's been over 20 years that I've been living the life of the householder yogi, and over 20 years that I've had these experiences with the kundalini energy and spiritual experiences and trying to balance both those lives. And what an absolute relief it is to have some dedicated time to just be able to go into my own secret closet within myself, go into the peace of my own being, undisturbed by any. What a great privilege that is. And what great things are happening within me. And I don't say this to build myself up in any way. I just want you to know. I want you to know what is possible. That the bliss, the peace, the glory, the fullness expression of the divine spirit. And it's not always easy. Sometimes it's difficult. Sometimes the opposing force comes in. Sometimes there's great hate, heat, and pain. But always, always there's that divine presence. And self-mastery is such a wonderful thing. You know, when we compare it to indulgence, we think indulgence, well, if I do this and that, it'll bring me some measure of happiness. But self-mastery is such a wonderful thing. Such a wonderful thing. And the feeling of peace, feeling of belongingness, of oneness, is terrific. It's interesting that we are hearing Master's voice before the meditation tonight. Because as I sat upstairs beforehand, I felt his presence in such great degree. You know, if you have the opportunity, there's Self-Realization Fellowship down in Los Angeles, and there's Mount Washington, which is where he spent many of his years from 1920 onward. And the vibration there is so thick that for the attuned soul, you walk onto those grounds and you just feel it. The air is saturated with it. And unfortunately, it seems a little bit with time that it's diluted a little bit, but I think it's still terrific what's there. And that same vibration was in the room so thick and so present that it just felt to be in the very same place. And I knew it to be Master's vibration. It's an interesting thing. When you experience the presence of these different masters, each one is pure God. You can experience that. You can feel it. You know it in yourself as you experience their vibration. But at the same time, they have their own unique vibrancy about them. It's as if there's a signature on those vibrations. And it's unique to that soul. And so at the same time, it's completely God, and yet is filled with the individuality of that soul. And so many of the masters have come to visit and in their vibrations been very present, and sometimes through inner vibrations, so sometimes through inner visions, and in other ways. And so through this way, we attune ourselves more and more to that highest consciousness. But beyond any form, we should always reach out for that universal consciousness. We should not, because form can be limiting. So when these forms come to us, as they will as we deepen our meditation and we feel the beauty, ask of them to bless you with the universal vision, because you want to see that vibration that they represent in all of creation, in all peoples, in all situations. That is the universal vision. You are tuned into that vibration always. You see what a wonderful thing it is? Because it is filled with bliss. It is filled with joy and love and wisdom. Wisdom. And you are no longer pushed about by the desires of this body and of this ego. But rather, you feel yourself inspired moment to moment with the divine consciousness. So let us not deny ourselves of that beatitude any longer through our indifference. There are many obstacles that come up in this path. Indifference is one of them. Lust, greed, anger, desire for powers are some others. Gluttony. You see, all of these things come up and they compete for our consciousness, the purity of our own selves. So when we experience these things, we should not feel bad about ourselves. They're natural. They're things that come from the body, from old habit patterns. There are things that we have to face. But face them we should, and bravely. And master them. Seek God beyond all these other things. And then all these other things will be added unto you. All the realms of other vibrational aspects will be yours. But not until you have the top. So go to the top first. So my prayer for you is to feel that vibration. Feel the vibration of peace. Feel the vibration of God. That your consciousness will become so identified with it that you'll realize your oneness with it. And there will be no longer two, but only one. You see, and that even goes beyond God the Father and God the Mother. There is only one. Papa Ramdas used to say, first comes bhakti, the love for God and the desire to know truth. Then comes jnani, the state of jnani. And that is rising above all the material vibrations and knowing that spiritual consciousness as one. See, that's becoming one with God the Father. But there's a state beyond that, and that is called para-bhakti, beyond bhakti, beyond your search. And that is, you see that the eternal spirit, the eternal self within you, and all material creation are all part of the one same vibration of the original creative spirit. And that is called Sahaja Samadhi, of which Mother had and of which Papa had. And that is the highest. Because there is no longer any duality, any separation, even between soul and spirit. The bubble bursts and becomes the sea. And then reforms as the bubble, but knows that the bubble and the sea are not different. And so dissolution and creation continually happens, but it's all one movement of one vast ocean. And this can be yours. anybody would like individual interviews, I'll have availability tomorrow. You can ask me afterwards. And also there will be a meditation here in 2 weeks, Al?
Yes.
On Friday. 2 weeks. You please pray after me. O Heavenly Father.
O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
Of thy glorious presence.
Of thy glorious presence.
In every part of my being.
In every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
And surrender myself to thee.
And surrender myself to thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss
of my communion with thee.
Of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am he.
Blessed Spirit, I am he.
Peace. Peace. Peace.